Today, I'm so happy to welcome back my return guest and my friend, Terry Daniel. Terry is an interspiritual hospice chaplain, end-of-life educator, and grief counselor. She is the founder of the Conference on Death, Grief, and Belief and the Ask Dr. Death podcast, where I'm sometimes a co-host at times. And Terry's the author of 4 books on death, grief, and the afterlife. And you can find out all about Terry and her work at her website, which is danieldirect.net. So Terry, welcome back again. And thank you for joining me, my friend. It's so nice to have another discussion.
I love it that we both have these podcasts because it's the only way we ever get to talk to each other.
So I know.
So
I mean,
we
send emails and texts occasionally, but it's so nice to sit down and we have a whole hour to actually be face to face virtually and have a conversation. And we have planned today, because you're living in Oregon right now and working there in hospice, to talk about medical aid in dying from the chaplain's perspective. And Oregon was the first state to legalize medical aid in dying, if I'm correct.
Yes, it was in 1998. And in fact, I just went to a fundraising event last month for this organization called End of Life Choices Oregon. We call it ELCOR. It used to be called Compassion and Choices, which some people know. Mm-hmm. And they were the organization that got this to happen back in 1998. And at this event that I went to, many of the original people who've been there for 25 years were at this party and totally volunteer. And they've been doing it for 25 years. So bravo to them. Yes, Oregon was the first.
That's amazing to me, 1998, because it seems to me, I don't know, medical aid in dying seems like we're just at the forefront of it right now. But to think that that people were interested in it and actually got that law passed that long ago is really amazing to me. What pioneers they were.
Yeah. And they're still there. That's what's just, you know, walking around that party and meeting people and they're telling me, oh yeah, I was there in 98. You know, I helped pass the legislation. I just wanted to bow down to them because it's huge. And ELCOR, and I have to preface this by saying I am not the absolute expert on all the technical and legal and certainly medical stuff here, but I will just share what I know. ELCOR sort of manages all of these deaths in Oregon. Death with Dignity, we also call it MAID, Medical Aid in Dying, or MAID. And so generally what happens when somebody here wants to do MAID, they'll contact ELCOR. And ELCOR will connect them to a doctors to do the evaluation, to issue the prescription. They will come to your house and be with you when you take the medicine. They'll work with your hospice and your family. They do everything.
Yeah, that's really wonderful to provide that kind of assistance for people. I live half the year in Colorado, which passed the End of Life Options Act a few years ago. And we're finding it's a slow takeoff in a way. I mean, everyone's happy the law got passed, but it takes a while to get physicians trained and even to get them to buy into it and to be willing to write the prescriptions and then to get pharmacists trained to have the meds on hand and to be comfortable filling those prescriptions. So it seems like it's been a big task in our state, and a lot of patients are struggling to just get through the process and get what they need to utilize this act.
Yeah, there's so much in what you just said, and Colorado's a pretty conservative state. So it was Colorado, I think they passed it around 2014, because that's when we met our mutual friend, Aaliyah Alexander, who did it in, I believe, 2016, and it had just been passed. Mm-hmm. Then interesting about the pharmacist, I'm going to tell you a funny story. A death with dignity, funny story. A friend of mine was with a friend who was going to do death with dignity. And my friend, her name is Julie, went to the pharmacy to pick up the prescription for her friend. And you know how when you go to the pharmacy and you get a prescription, they hand it over to you and they say, have you taken this medication before?
Yeah, it's their standard line.
That's what they said to her. They handed her the bag. I guess the clerk or the cashier didn't know what it was. And she was just
What? I mean, that is a really funny story when I think about it. And did you know the possible side effects from this medication?
Yeah, I mean, because it wasn't, and I'm surprised because I would think with a prescription like this, that the pharmacists themselves would be the one to come and hand it to you and talk to you. I would think that that is required, and maybe it is. And maybe in this case, the person who did that was just the kid who works at the pharmacy. You know, I don't know. It's a pretty funny story.
Well, it's interesting because there really are a lot of people involved in the chain of things that have to happen. And I don't know, in Oregon, do patients have to have two different doctors sign off on it?
Yes. And so the last time I heard, and I have to tell you, this changes all the time. So what I'm saying now may not be current when somebody's listening to this. But the last time I heard, what has to happen is you go to one doctor and you get an examination, you get approved. Then there's a waiting period that last I heard was, I think, 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks. I believe they've shortened that waiting period now. I don't know. And then you go to the second doctor. And so they give you, they check out your medical status and your mental status. And if you get these two approvals, then you can get the prescription. Now, perhaps one of these doctors can issue the prescription, or Elcor has a doctor that can do it, but you definitely have to have the two approvals. The thing that's so tricky about this is that every state is different, and they are vastly different. It's a huge spectrum. So again, I don't have exact accurate numbers on this because it changes all the time, but I believe in Vermont, that waiting period was like between checkups, I think was like 2 days. In Hawaii, it's 10 days. It's different everywhere. Oregon just stopped having a residency requirement. In some places, you have to be a resident. So you have to literally rent an apartment, show a utility bill or something to prove that you actually live in the state. Oregon had that too. People were coming here and doing that. We're leasing rooms in people's houses for a period of time.
I remember when Brittany Maynard moved from California to Oregon in order to access the law before California passed its own law.
Right. Now you don't have to be a resident. So now an interesting thing that we're working on here is, if somebody wants to come here and do it, now you have to do it here. You can't pick up the prescription and then take it back to Kansas and do it there. Where are they going to do it? So they contact Elcor, they come in, they go to the doctor's appointments, they stay here for a few weeks to get all of that done. Now they have the prescription in their hand. They're staying at a hotel. Is that where they're going to die? And, what does the hotel think about this? Like all these people coming to the Marriott, and all of a sudden they're finding people, are being carried out dead from their hotels. So that's an interesting issue. And so one of the things that Elcor does now is they contract, not contract, but they connect with people who have like Airbnbs or have houses to rent who support this and are willing to let people come and do it in their house. Which is, my friend Sarah, who's a chaplain, who's also very involved in this, we had this great idea to buy a building and make like an inpatient center where people could come and the families could stay and do death with dignity, and we would provide the residence for them. It was a great idea, but then we realized that we'd have to raise millions of dollars, and it was a little bit beyond our scope.
But those are really interesting things to think about, and I can see how helpful Elcor is then, because first of all, to already have vetted doctors, and so to know, so patients don't waste their time trying to go to their own doctor and get rejected and waste even more time, trying to find a physician who's willing to write the prescription. But that's such a good point that some people may not want to, even if they live there, they may not want to do this at their own home for one reason or another. And
Right.
they may want to find another place where more people could gather and be with them.
Now, somebody I know, my chaplain friend, has a friend who has a beach house who actually allows people to come and stay at her beach house for a weekend to do it. And, if I owned a property like that, I would love to be that person who just says, come do it here. I am a hospice chaplain. I can even help. Interesting about rejection. And I don't know how this works, Karen. I mean, you are a physician. If I asked you to write me that prescription, are you allowed to? Probably not. I don't know.
As long as I have the DEA license, I can write prescriptions. But if I'm in the state,
but
where
I'd
it's
have
legal,
to be approved. You'd have to maybe be part of something.
Yeah, and know that you were already approved before, right, and had the certifications. But then, and also be educated about what to prescribe and what's available, because I know the prescriptions have changed. I had a conversation a couple months ago with Nurse Gabrielle Elise Jimenez, and she talked about the fact that the meds have changed in the last year that are being utilized. That's true in California for sure. But so physicians have to stay up to date and have to know what's available at the pharmacy, what dosages do you prescribe, and even to be able to educate patients about how to take the meds, though LCOR probably is very helpful for that as well.
Yeah. They stay on top of all of that. And you mentioned about being rejected. It's interesting timing. I just got a call this morning from someone at a hospice where I sometimes work. And she was asking me, they had a patient who wanted to do this and called our local hospital and asked them for a referral for a doctor who they could do the death with dignity process with. So the hospital gave them a name of a doctor. They called this doctor's office, and the person on the phone was very rude to them and very dismissive and shaming and just, wouldn't take, was just so uncooperative, and they couldn't understand why she was being so mean. And so the hospice called me and said, do you know this doctor? Why did this happen? I said, I'm guessing that the hospital was looking down a list of names and gave you the wrong name. Because anybody who would be on a referral list for Death with Dignity would be very nice to you on the phone. So you, or maybe they had someone in their office answering the phone that day who just didn't approve of it and just thought it was perfectly fine to be mean to the person. And she didn't know about LCOR. So I referred her to LCOR and I said, just go there if they'll know what to do. But I imagine that a lot of people trying to do this on their own would run up against a lot of rejection and shaming.
Yeah, I've talked to a number of physicians who are totally uncomfortable. They don't understand it. They feel like, this isn't my role. I'm here to help people get better. That's what my focus is. I don't want to be involved in this. They felt like it's outside their mission in life, mm-hmm. And what they're here to do. And I think we have to respect that too, for anyone who doesn't feel comfortable, but in some cases it may just be that they need more education. And if they understood it better, they would feel more comfortable with it.
Well, you and I've talked about this 100 times about how, when it comes to death, all doctors need more education.
Definitely. Yeah. Very true.
Yeah. It is outside their mission, but the Hippocratic Oath has been around for, hundreds and hundreds of years. And that was before we had the technology to keep people alive into their 90s by extreme medical interventions and technology. Back in ancient Greece or Rome or wherever that came from, this was not a possibility. So it was just save people all the time, because people mm-hmm. were dying at 40, 50 years old. So that mission is really no longer relevant.
Yeah, it's so true. That mindset hasn't evolved very much with the changing times and with what the patient's needs are right now at this point. But I know that some hospices also reject the idea of medical aid in dying. Yeah. So even beyond the physicians, I've heard from patients who had a hospice kick them off kick them out because they wanted to use medical aid in dying.
Well, that's another interesting thing that's, an issue, and it's ever changing right now. So as it stands right now, as I understand it, and again, I don't know everything about this, each individual hospice can come up with its own policy. And that policy is basically shaped by whoever is the boss of the hospice, the executive director Or, and even with a big corporate hospice like the one that I work for that has 200 offices across the country, we don't have a corporate, official corporate policy. Each individual office can say where they stand on that. I know that in California, there is a law that says a hospice has to state its death with dignity policy on its website and in its printed materials. It has to be published and stated. That law may exist in other states. I only know of it in California. And each individual hospice is different. So I would say to anybody considering doing this while on hospice is to find out what their policy is. It used to be, not that many years ago, that if you were on hospice and you wanted to do MAID, you had to be discharged from hospice. That was just the case all across the board. That's not true anymore, but maybe, again, it's different in every hospice. In every hospice that I worked for here in Oregon, you don't have to be discharged anymore. You can still be on hospice. In fact, some people come to hospice just so that they can do this. And we'll take care of you. We'll give you all the hospice services. And here's where it starts to vary. Some hospices have a policy that our staff, let's say you're the patient and you've developed a close relationship with the chaplain or the social worker or the nurse, and you want them to be there. Let's say the chaplain. I want the chaplain to be there. Some hospices are like, fine, that's great. Some hospices say, nope, nobody on our staff can be in the room when the patient drinks the medicine. Soon as they're done ingesting the medicine, the staff member can come right back in, but you can't be there during the delivery process. I personally think this is a really good idea because it eliminates any possibility that the hospice could be accused of hastening the death. The way the law works is nobody is allowed to hand that cup of stuff to the patient and help them drink it. The patient has to be able to pick up the cup, drink, and swallow on their own with no help. If anybody crosses that line and puts the cup to their lips, it's murder. So hospice people don't want to go anywhere near that, right? So
yeah, and that makes so much sense given that one of the misperceptions about hospice that we've been dealing with for years is that hospice hastens death and that we overdose people with morphine so they'll die faster. And so because we're still fighting that myth about hospice, it makes sense. You don't want to appear to be going in the other direction and just exactly. Fostering even more fears about what hospice does.
And that's why I like the idea of the hospice staff being out of the room during medication delivery. Then you can come right back in. But not all hospices require that. If it was me, I would just do that because it just feels safer for the hospice. Yeah.
And it makes sense if there were a disgruntled family member who didn't agree with the decision,
exactly.
who might come back and, try to blame the hospice and try to take action against the hospice
I'm sure that's happened a lot of times, I'm sure. I've had some interesting stories about that. So in terms of disgruntled family members, these are some of the issues, I know of this case. This woman was young. She was in her 50s. I don't know her diagnosis, but I'm thinking it was something like ALS that has a very clear-cut trajectory. We know where that's going. She lived alone. She was still functional and independent. She had family that lived nearby, but they weren't really involved. She didn't need a lot of care at this point. But ALS. And so she decided to do death with dignity, and she did not want her family to know. Her family being her, maybe her sister, maybe her mother was still alive. I wasn't directly involved in this case. So the hospice had two different views of this. The chaplain was like, absolutely, you're a cognitively functional adult. You have HIPAA protection. It's between you and yourself. Your decisions are protected. Nowhere is there any law that says we have to tell your family that you're doing this. The social worker at the hospice objected to this and said, no, you can't do that. You can't lie to the family. You can't withhold this information. The family needs to know. So this was discussed all over the place. And the bottom line was, no, the family doesn't need to know because your privacy extends to anybody you want it to extend to, even your husband or wife or children. So she went ahead and did it. And the other thing that comes into this is when you die with death with dignity, the cause of death on the death certificate is your primary terminal diagnosis. So if you have lung cancer, that's what's going to say. On hers, I expect that it said ALS. But couldn't it, and this, I don't know the answer to this, couldn't it also just say cardiac arrest? Because that's how you die.
I mean, it could be. And sometimes some people interpret the death certificate that way. It's the actual last event that happened before you died. But then they would put a secondary diagnosis, say, of ALS, you know, cardiac arrest due to ALS, or as a secondary diagnosis. But I don't know. I don't know if that, I don't know. It would be interesting to see the person completing the death certificate, what they decided to put on it to preserve the patient's privacy. That's a very interesting, and I never thought about that, that the family might not actually know that that was the patient's choice.
And they're not supposed to put death with dignity. You don't put that on a death certificate.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's the privacy, that part of it is always hidden. It's a, you know, physiological cause of death. And so the way this was done is, you know, she did the medicine, she had the LCOR people there and the chaplain there, and then she died. And the hospice called the family and said she has passed peacefully. And I don't, again, I wasn't directly involved, so I don't have all the details, but if the family said, well, what do you mean she was passed? You know, she was fine the other day. I just talked to her. I don't really know what they would say. Her heart stopped. She stopped breathing. I don't know. But the edgy thing is you don't want to lie.
Yeah.
And, but you do have to tell the family something. You have to notify somebody. How do you do that? I don't know. And there is no answer to this. This is just a discussion that is going on.
Wow. That would be a really tough position to be in. To feel like you were keeping information from the family. And it makes me feel sad, because some of what I understand to be the beauty about these deaths is being able to have loved ones in the room and present with you. So it's very sad that that wasn't possible for whatever reason, that family might not have supported that decision.
Yeah. And imagine, you know, how hard it is to make this decision in the first place, and then have your closest people trying to talk you out of it the whole time and shaming you and telling you it's a sin against God and, you know, all the stuff that they would say. So I, you know, I understand why this woman wanted to do it this way.
Yeah. Well, I know, I mean, I know there's, I'm sure there's still a lot of concern that choosing medical aid in dying is the same as suicide. And even I looked at it that way in the very beginning when I first started hearing about it. But for me, part of it is the trauma I still carry from my dad dying by suicide, and feeling like, oh, I don't want to encourage people to take their own lives because of how much pain it caused me. But it was actually someone I interviewed from Compassion and Choices back then who said, but it's totally different because this is a planned decision and the whole family's involved in it. It's not a shocking, sudden event that came from nowhere that feels totally wrong. It's actually, it's planned, it's beautiful, and it's loving. And she helped me recognize, okay, it's not the same, and it doesn't have the same impact on a family member as a suicide might.
Not at all. And besides the fact that it's supported and loving and all that, it's somebody choosing to be out of pain. Now, suicide is also somebody choosing to be out of pain. But what happens with suicide is basically they're saying, my pain is so hard for me to bear that I'm going to just leave and leave my pain with you.
Exactly.
They're basically transferring their pain to the people who are close to them. When somebody is facing ALS or death by brain cancer or any of this stuff, they're not transferring their pain to the other person. Obviously, the other person's going to grieve and miss them, but the family members, the other person is already in pain watching this person suffer and decline. So in that sense, you're actually relieving pain for everybody. You know, and it's almost, I mean, if it was me and my family, I would say, okay, you know, here are the choices. You can continue to take care of me and watch me suffer and watching me slowly die, or I can end this for all of us in a way that will be peaceful and easy and agreeable. That's the choice.
And having an opportunity to create while the person is still cognitively able to participate and be present, to create a ritual or a ceremony for the moment of death that could be just filled with so much love and beauty and sacredness, really.
Yeah. Yes. And so you and I talked in our last interview about rituals, about a ceremony that I did just like that. And so I'll bring it up again. This was a friend who did have also had ALS, and she was already declining. She was in a wheelchair and she needed help with everything. She was young, probably in her early 50s, and she had a date scheduled to do her death with dignity. And the day before, she had a gathering, and there were about 30 of us there. All her friends came, her family from all over the country. People flew in. They were also going to be present the next day when she took the medicine. Some of them were, not all of them. And so she asked me to do a ceremony for her. And what I did, I'll show you a picture in a minute, is I gave everybody in the room a piece of ribbon about this long. And each person was going to walk up to her sitting in her wheelchair and tie a ribbon around her wrist with a blessing. So someone would tie it around her wrist and say, you know, you've been my best friend since we were children. I've lived my whole life with you. I love you so much. And I'll never forget you. And I bless you on this journey. And then somebody else would tie a ribbon with their story about her. She happened to be one of my counselors in college who got me my first hospice internship.
Wow.
So when I came time for me to tie my ribbon, I said, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. You launched my career. You gave me my first opportunity when I was an undergrad. So then in the end, she's sitting there with all these ribbons dangling off her wrists, and she kept them on for the next day. She took a shower that night, and then the next day she took the medicine. And so she died with these ribbons on her wrist. I'll share my screen and show this beautiful picture. Oh, host disabled participant screen sharing.
Oh, oops. Whoops. Oh, wait. Here, I can make you, I'll make you a host.
Anyway, so she had that. So then when she took the medicine, so she died with these blessings tied around her wrist, and she was cremated with those also tied around her wrist. So all of that love from all of those people went with her on her journey. And there she is.
Oh, wow.
And you can see the little ribbons here.
So beautiful.
Tied around both wrists. And here she's drinking a glass of champagne out of a straw, which is hilarious. And a little piece of Kleenex because we were all crying. And over here in the background, that's her husband. And he has his thing around his wrist too. And then in the end, after we all put these on her, we each put one on each other. So you would turn to the person sitting next to you and tie one around their wrist so that in the end, we were all sitting in a circle and everybody had one of these around their wrist, and she had all of these. And
wow.
She went to her death with that.
Oh, wow. That's beautiful.
That was so beautiful.
That really touches me. Terry, what an amazing ceremony you created.
And, you know, this is, I mean, how this death with dignity thing, what a gift. How never have we had this opportunity to do it, you know, sanctioned by the medical establishment and the government, if that's important to anybody, you know, and we don't have to go off in the woods and shoot ourselves or overdose on opioids or something. You know, we can do this in a respectful way, and it's beautiful. But not everybody thinks it's respectful and beautiful.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, as a chaplain, do some chaplains feel a conflict of interest around supporting medical aid in dying?
Absolutely, 100%. The chaplain where I work now won't participate in it at all. He's Catholic. He's a former priest. Many, many chaplains want, and that's fine. They don't have to, you know. And again, even the hospice can say no. A hospice can still tell you, you have to check out of hospice if you want to do death with dignity. This is not standardized even within a state. And again, I'm not the absolute expert on this. So speaking of chaplains, like here's a religious argument. Sorry about my phone there. The religious argument goes something like this. And the best way I can explain it is to sort of put it in a scenario. So we'll have two people. We'll have the patient and the patient's daughter. Daughter is having a religious objection. So the patient says, you know, okay, patient's diagnosed with a terrible disease. She's got fourth stage lung cancer, brain cancer, something that you know you're not going to recover from. And she wants to do death with dignity. And the daughter says, but mom, you only God can say when you're going to die. And then mom says, well, God gave me brain cancer. So maybe that's when I was supposed to die. You know, maybe brain cancer is not a good example, something that there's intervention for. I don't know, Karen, you pick one. You know these better than I do.
Oh, I think lung cancer is a...
Okay. All right. Lung cancer. So, you know, you have all the interventions like, well, God gave me lung cancer 5 years ago and I should have died then, but I've had all these treatments and I'm still here. So I overruled God by staying alive. And now I'm alive, but, you know, we know that I'm not going to live and I'm going to suffer and I'm not going to be able to breathe. And I want to make this decision. Well, only God can decide when you're going to die. Well, you know, I changed God's mind already once, and maybe God is deciding that I get to die this way because God also gave us death with dignity, just like God gave us chemotherapy and surgery and lung transplants and all these other things that I've had. You know, that's the objection, is that you're going against the will of God by choosing the date of your own death. What people who have that objection don't realize is you've been going against the will of God, so to speak, all along. Every treatment you've had goes against supposedly what apparently God wanted you to die. Well, no, God didn't want you to die because you lived. Okay, well, now the cancer is progressing and I'm not going to live. I'm just going to suffer. So I guess, you know, does God want me to die now or continue living? Well, God wants you to live. God will tell you when it's time to die. So God wants me to suffer and gasp for air and for my whole family to be watching me suffer like this and go bankrupt with my care and caregiving? Is that what God wants? And it's circular reasoning. That's why mm-hmm. we call it circular reasoning. It just goes around and around and around and around, and there's no answer.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've heard a similar discussion just about even going on hospice, like foregoing treatment in order to go on hospice. And patients saying, well, no, that would be playing God. Right. If I stop treatment and go on hospice, then I'm playing God. And my argument, same as yours, was, however, getting treatment might be playing God, actually. Getting the treatment in the first place, you could look at it either way. And I mean, I think it all comes down to people's basic beliefs and what they think about God. But I wonder also if it's still people confusing medical aid and dying with suicide, and it feels to them like something that's just wrong, that shouldn't be, that's an unforgivable sin or something in their eyes.
Well, if that's the case, then that would come from the belief that the church has deemed suicide a sin. What a lot of people don't know is that that's not true anymore. The official edict from the Pope now is that assisted death for someone who's suffering is actually not a sin in the same way that suicide is. So most people don't know that that rule has changed, which is so interesting about religion, because if all these doctrines and rules supposedly came from God, then how come human men get to change them?
And why are they all so different?
And why are they all so different and they change all the time? So it may be that it's mixed with suicide, but I really think it's more, and people who believe this are confused. You know, it's like, well, then a liver transplant is playing God. I was born with this liver. God made me an alcoholic. And now my liver is shot. And if I replace it, then I'm playing God. God wants me to die from liver failure to punish me for being an alcoholic. I mean, it just goes everywhere. All over the map.
Yeah. And I mean, you can make an argument for any one of those cases, depending on what your beliefs are. So I guess ultimately it comes down to an individual's decision, but it's interesting that even in hospice, it's an individual decision based on who's running the hospice and how they feel about it, what choices they make. And maybe that's the right thing for now, because it's controversial. It's good. Nobody's forced to think one way or behave one way. Everyone has the right to decide how they feel about it and what their beliefs are.
One other thing that happens in hospice, and this is a big thing too, is there's a don't ask, don't tell rule. That's probably true in all of medical care, not just hospice, but at least the rule in most hospices is if a patient asks about it, you can tell them about it. If a patient says, do we have death with dignity in this state? You can say, yes, we do. And here's the phone number for LCOR. Call them and they will help you with it. We're not supposed to guide them in any way to that. Just make a referral. If the patient doesn't ask and they say something like, I just don't want to live. Isn't there just a pill you can give me so that I can hurry up and die? If they're not specifically asking for death with dignity by name, we can't offer it in some hospices. I happen to know that here in Oregon at Kaiser, just that comment, I just want to die, isn't there a pill you can give me, is enough for them to open their conversation. They're allowed to do that. In certain hospices that I know, unless they specifically ask for death with dignity, don't ask, don't tell.
Wow.
And it just seems to me that it should be offered in the very first hospice consultation meeting, in the intake meeting with the family, because here's what we say. We'll give you nursing care. We'll give you a CNA to come and help you with bathing. You'll have a chaplain. You'll have a social worker. You'll have a music therapist. We'll provide your hospital beds and all your medication. Here are all the services that we give you and all the options. You can sign out anytime. You can keep your regular doctor. Here's all the stuff. Death with dignity should be one of those things that's offered. And, you know, we haven't gotten that enlightened yet.
Yeah, and it's so tricky because, I mean, you really have to understand what you're working with in your state, in the hospice where or hospital where you're working, and then really listen to the individual patients you're working with. But I'm curious to know about VSED, voluntarily stopping eating and drinking, and if those same hospices, the hospices who reject MAID, would feel the same way about VSED, because then it seems to be completely the patient's choice whether they eat or drink or stop that. And all of our hospice patients eventually stop eating and drinking anyway at the very end of life.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's all a patient's choice. You know, they can stop eating and drinking by, you know, voluntarily, or they can do death with dignity, which is a lot easier. And I've never encountered any objection to telling a patient about VSED, you know, to telling them, well, you know, it, lots of times patients will say, how do I speed this along? You know, I don't want to make my family take care of me for the next year like this. And you're allowed to tell them. You know, one thing that you could do if you really want to is stop eating and drinking, but it means stop everything, not even a drop of water. And if the person is not progressed enough in their disease to the point where digestion doesn't work anymore, it's really hard to do that if you're still a functioning person who needs calories. Your body will eventually tell you to stop.
Yeah. Yeah, but if you're not at that point yet, it's really tough. I don't know very many people who could actually follow through with it and carry it out because it's so challenging.
I knew one person who was doing it, but you know, she got really thirsty, and so she was having sips of orange juice a few times a day, and that will keep you alive.
Yeah, just a little moisture and a few calories, and that's enough.
Yeah. You know, like a few teaspoons of orange juice every day will probably keep somebody alive. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I always want to emphasize in our conversations is that there's a lot of beauty in these deaths. And you and I both know someone in Colorado. I mean, she's your friend, but I met her through you.
She's your friend too.
Who with ALS again, no, MS,
MS, yeah.
MS, who made the choice after the End of Life Options Act passed in Colorado, to utilize that. And I don't know if you could just tell us the story of her death, because I understand it was also, she was so intentional, she was so spiritual, and she excuse me, she had everything so sorry. She had everything so well planned for herself, and it was really beautiful. So if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about that
Yeah,
experience.
she did an amazing job. So she got MS when she was in her early 40s, and she had been a really active person. She was an equestrian horse riding star. She was a social worker. She had a very big life, and she had three kids, I think. And by the time I met her in about 2012-ish, she was completely paralyzed. Except for one finger. And I don't know how MS works. That seems very strange to me, but that's how it was for her. And with her one finger, and she could move her head, she spent all her time in a recliner chair. She had caregivers around the clock. And she had this computer system rigged up in front of her that she could use her little finger and her eyes to dictate and type. And she wrote blogs, she wrote a book, she did all of this. Completely paralyzed. And her family, she moved to this place in Colorado from, I think, Philadelphia. Her family wanted to control her life and tell her how to manage it. And she just independently found a way to move to this beautiful place. Anyway, she planned it all out. I went to see her in Colorado and did a grief ceremony for her family before she died. She wanted to have all of that done right in front of her eyes while she was still there. So we had the whole family and the friends, and we did a weekend grief ceremony for her
Wow.
where everybody could say their goodbyes and do some grief processes. And it was the most beautiful thing. And we did all of that. I can't even remember what we did. We burned some stuff outside and some messages to her we buried in the earth. She got to do all this while she was still alive. And then she did medical aid in dying, and she invited her closest friends around, and they took her outside. She wanted to be outdoors under the stars. And then she did an open air cremation, which is also legal in Colorado, out in where she lived in the middle of nowhere in this little town called Crestone in the mountains. And I wasn't there for that. I wish I could have been. And just the way it is done in the natural world, you know, out in a field, cremating in front of everybody, sending her essence up into the cosmos. Just she was the most beautiful people in the world. I can tell you her name. Her name was Aaliyah Alexander. You can Google her. You can read her blog. You can read her book. One of the last things she wrote in her blog was something called A Love Letter to My Body, where she
Wow.
just told her body everything she wanted to say to it before she left. She was incredible. Hello, Aaliyah, if you're listening.
Wow, she is. I have goosebumps.
I know.
She was amazing, and I felt so privileged to have a chance to meet her and be in her presence. And she's a person who she lived her life so fully within this awful disease that took almost everything away from her. And no one could deny her the right to make the choice that she made and to die in the way in which she did, because she gave life everything. She gave it all of her energy, all of her spirit. She gave everything to it, and it was such perfection for her to be able to choose the time and place when she was ready to go. And It was so much more humane and dignified and sacred, the fact that she was able to be such a participant all along the way, than to have her fall into a coma and be unable to breathe and, you know, and struggling for breath in her last days. And so I can't imagine that anyone would want to deny her that choice that she was able to make.
And she also paid her dues to her suffering long enough. That's another thing, especially with the God question. So if we go back to that, like, well, God, only God can decide when you should die. Well, how long does God want me to suffer? How long does God want me to lay here in a recliner chair, unable to move? She was already beginning to lose the ability to talk in whole sentences. How long, you know, how long am I required to be in this state of suffering before God thinks it's okay to relieve me of this? And she had suffered long enough. And it's really, she was like, I paid my dues. I've been in this body, in this chair for 15 years. Enough. Why shouldn't we have the right to make that decision?
Exactly.
If we don't decide, who does?
Exactly. She embraced the illness. She lived with it. She did, in fact, she did incredible things for the world while she was going through this illness for all those years. And she didn't run away from suffering at all. She was present for all of it. And yeah, it's quite an incredible story. And she inspired me as well to keep opening my mind more and more about medical aid in dying, which I'm at a completely different place with it now than back a number of years ago when I first started thinking about it and talking about it. But she's one of the people that really helped me open to it.
Nice. That's nice. And you met her, you went to her house.
Mm-hmm.
And just to kind of meet her, right?
Yeah, because I was on a little retreat in Crestone myself. I went there for like a 5-day retreat. I think I had mentioned to you, I'm going to be
right.
in Crestone. And you said, you need to meet my friend.
Yeah.
And it was just life-changing
yeah.
to talk with her and be near her. And I was so grateful that you connected us.
She, when I was there to do that ceremony with her, she said, go in my bedroom and go in my closet and take any of my clothes that you want. And she had beautiful clothes, like, you know, stuff from Tibet and just, and I have them all. She was a little smaller than me, so I couldn't wear all of them, but I have those clothes in my closet. I would never get rid of them. They mean everything to me. I opened the closet and there's her Tibetan vest and her scarf, you know, and I just love it. So that's another thing you can do. You know, you can say goodbye to your family, make sure all your legal affairs are in order, give away your clothes and your possessions, and just wrap it up. So this is something, Karen, you and I have talked about before. In the old days, before the Industrial Revolution or before the medicalization of death, the way people died in the natural world is you'd be a farmer or a coal miner or something, and you'd be out there working, and you've got black lung or, you know, whatever you've got. And you just would know one day that you were done. And you'd walk in the house and you'd say to your wife, my time has come. I'm dying. And you would go lay down on the bed. You would call your sons, tell them to go out in the barn and start building your coffin, call the priest, call the neighbors and give away whatever you wanted to do, and just lay down and die, because you knew, because you could feel it in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And now what we do when we feel that is we call 911 and we get patched up and we don't die. And we do this again and again and again. And so in that process, I know we've talked about this before. Have we lost touch with that intuition that tells us when our body's done, because we have learned not to listen to it?
Oh, I think that's such a good point. I think that's exactly right. I think we've repressed it and ignored it so long that I'm sure it's still there. We each still would have that intuition, but we can't even listen to it or hear it now.
Yeah, I guess it's still there, because it's like, you know, like, of course you listen to your body. Like right now, I know I have to go to the doctor because I know I need a knee replacement. You know, my body is screaming at me that I have a bad knee and I have to do something about it, you know? 100 years ago, there'd be nothing you could do about it. Just walk around on a crutch, you know, and become disabled. So should, you know, I'm 70 years old. Should I get a knee replacement? Absolutely. I'm not ready to die because of one knee. But so, you know, we do listen to our bodies. But when you look at somebody like Aaliyah, her body is speaking so loudly that, you know, or so many of these patients that I see in hospice that are in care facilities that are bed bound, they've got bed sores, they're in pain, so many things going on. They're very old. They might have dementia. Their family doesn't visit them anymore because they don't recognize their family. At this point now, they can't make a decision. Now they're stuck. They can't do death with dignity. But Karen, there's you're the one who showed this to me. There's this dementia option now on advanced directives, mm-hmm. right? How, tell us about that.
Yeah, and I'm not sure. I know so much about it, except that it allows people who know they have Alzheimer's or another type of dementia to say that they do not want to be resuscitated, to choose that in advance, and that they want that to be honored after they lose their cognitive ability so that they won't be resuscitated. Excuse me. I know of another a physician who was creating one that would allow people to say they did not want to be fed after they were no longer able to feed themselves. If they weren't capable of taking food, you know, putting food into their own mouths to eat, they no longer wanted to be fed by someone else, have someone else put the food in their mouths. And I think his advance directive was a little more controversial because it felt cruel to the caregivers to feel like they were withholding food and not giving it to the person. And he said, you provide the food, you put the food in front of them, but if they're unable to actually bring the food to their mouths, they don't eat because that's the state that their body is in. They're unable to feed themselves, and it would be a natural death then to stop eating at that time.
But so, what if they're unable to feed themselves because they have MS and they can't use their hands?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he only applies this to patients with dementia, but you're right. If it's some other condition and people are unable to feed themselves, we would never stop providing feeding. So I think there's a lot of controversy around that particular directive.
I just looked this up and I found this at Compassion and Choices. CompassionandChoices.org. And it basically says, if I have advanced dementia and I'm unable to feed myself due to advanced dementia, I want the following to apply. And then it's like an advanced directive. It has all of this comfort care. If I appear to be indifferent to food or being fed, that's important. Mm-hmm. If I no longer appear to desire to eat or drink, and all, if I don't voluntarily open my mouth to accept food, if I turn my head away, if I spit out food, if I cough, gag, choke on food. So there's that nuance.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense to me. I think that's very interesting.
I can put that in the chat box. I don't know if people will be able to access that, but here it is. I just put it in there.
Okay.
So what you do is you add that to your advanced directive right now while you're cognizant. And then 5 years from now, if you have dementia, it'll stand. It'll say, yes, I still want this, even though I can't say it now. What I said 5 years ago is on paper.
It's, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. And one thing I've been thinking about, Terry, is, you know, part of the Hippocratic Oath, you mentioned that for physicians, is to do no harm. And I think we need to remember that, because I think many people interpret that to mean, well, then you should do everything possible to save a person's life. But the fact is, sometimes we're doing harm when we don't allow people to die, when it's the right time for them to die. And when we allow them to continue suffering, or we expect them to, or we put them in a position where they don't have choice anymore about their suffering, to me, that's harm. And I think of that, I wonder if in a way that could apply to God as well. Does God honestly want harm to come to us? Shouldn't God be a do no harm kind of entity that doesn't want harm? And there are various types of harm. And so, right. I don't know.
The God question with harm is pretty funny. I mean, all you have to look at is the world is full of harm. You know?
So yeah.
Obviously God is fine with harm.
Apparently so. That's true.
But that's interesting. You know, the other thing about that too is we're really into this whole patient-centered care. Whatever the patient wants, that's what we do. And more and more, we need to be more holistic than that. It's not just what the patient wants. Sometimes you have to consider what the caregivers want. And in a perfect world, with a perfect family, the way it would work is everybody would get on board and have a meeting, and the patient would say, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. Or and let me say this another way. The patient would say, like, all right, the doctor has said that I can have another round of chemo and I might be able to live 6 more months. What do you think, family? And have an honest, hopefully an educated discussion where the hospice professional will be in the room with you. And you talk about what is this 6 months going to look like? And wife, how do you feel about taking care of me now through another round of chemo where that might kill me? And, you know, I'm 87 years old. And how do you all feel about me saying no to this and just going to hospice? It's a group decision. And really, this patient-centered care idea kind of doesn't always include that. It's kind of like whatever the patient wants. So if the patient's like, give me everything, you know, give me full code. Yeah, it is up to them. And the only reason that decision would hold is because the family's not involved in the decision-making process, or they don't have education, or they don't know what that 6 months is going to look like. And nobody, especially the primary care doctor, is going to be telling them, here's what could happen. You know, he could get a really bad reaction to the chemo. He could have a stroke. Anything could happen. And he'll be, you know, in a vegetative state in a nursing home, and he'll live for 5 years like that. That could happen. Nobody's telling them all of those possibilities.
And considering, isn't that harm? Isn't that doing harm to that person in a sense?
Yes.
Yeah, you're right. It should maybe be family-centered care, or it just has to be a bigger circle than just the patient alone.
Yeah, exactly. And then family is also an interesting term, because what is family? You know, some people have no family. Something I listened to a really good presentation the other day where the person was saying, we need to stop using the words loved ones when we're talking about death and grief. Because some people have those who are taking care of them that they don't love. You know, it's an abusive family, and it's like, it's the abusive dad who dies, and the grief condolence cards and the grief counselors are saying, oh, you know, we're going to, you know, talk about your loved one. And they're like, I didn't love him. He's not my loved one. We need to find another word for that.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. I don't know what the word would be. Anyone have any ideas? Send them to Karen.
Yeah. Well, Terry, thank you. This has been such a great discussion. It's always really fun to talk through these scenarios with you and situations. So I'm really grateful to you for all the work you're doing and your willingness to just sit down and have a deep conversation.
Back at you, my friend. And, you know, I'd rather talk about this than anything. So this is easy. This work is easy because it's got so much love in it.
Yeah. Yeah. We're both in our happy place.
We're in our happy place. Thank you, Karen.
Well, thank you, Terry.